Mallet, but we'll call this meeting to order. This is a committee meeting for anesthesia and sedation, March 3rd, 1 p.m. meeting. So we'll start off with a call to the public. There looks to be none here. Do you have anyone signed in? Okay. What?
Staff is out there, but I haven't seen anybody.
Nor have I. So I think we've accomplished our call to the public. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to review by email or in person the minutes from the last meeting. Looking for a motion to approve those minutes.
I move.
All right.
Second.
Second. All in favor of approving the minutes from the last committee meeting?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Hearing none, we'll move on. So, please, go ahead, Mr. Edmondson.
Can we just do a roll call?
Yes, thank you. I called to order, but I didn't roll call. So, Dr. Beanstock, if you could start, and then we'll go around.
Sure.
Oh, just kidding. Let you do your job.
Hi.
I don't know.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi. Thank you. Oh, well. Like I started today.
That's how I have it. Yeah. Goodman?
Present.
Bad guy. Beanstock?
Here.
Lazick? Brady?
Here.
Brownstein? Christensen?
Yeah, thank you.
Hero?
Here.
Jermaine?
Present.
Lauf?
Here.
Snell?
Here.
So can our minutes still be approved, or do you want us to...
No, that's good.
The same humans are here.
No.
Okay. All right. Well, good stuff. So if we can, let's move to item 7 on the agenda, if staff's ready for that. I think both items 7 and 6 are things that hopefully we could discuss before we get into the rest of the meat of the meeting. So starting off with 7, we had asked the staff to review what was happening in other states, other territories, other jurisdictions. Is that something that staff could talk to of how that's going?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So we divided it up. There's 55 total jurisdictions, and I don't think all 55 jurisdictions have either a dental board or a we thought it was going to be like a small document, but as we started going through this, we thought this is going to turn out to be a very large project for us, but ultimately for you, because the document is not going to be small. It's going to be very large. Just assuming what we have the very first one. So it's 4 pages for just one. And it's all so our thought was, you guys are in the dental community way more than us.
I'm not, but yeah, that's.
So, is there a specific location in the corridors? I understand you can go on almost every field, or somewhere. And so there's some states that have better statutes and rules, I think, rules are dictating over all professions or even singular professions. Is there a specific jurisdiction that you're aware of that you like better, or do you still want to look at potentially of all statutes?
So you want to see if we can pare it down, not include American Guam and Puerto Rico?
No,
I don't know. I'm nothing against those places. But.
No, I included the 5 U.S. territories as well in giving up these as staff how we were going to go through this, but ultimately you as a whole, sitting as a committee, would pare down what you like best out of these. But I don't know how you're going to ever. Across 55 jurisdictions, we're going to see that this is better than this, take some time, and we've already started the process, but as we started it, it's going to get used, and I don't know that this is exactly what the committee wants, and we need to be involved.
What jurisdiction, or, yeah, what states, which ones have been reviewed so far?
I don't have a list in front
of me.
Okay,
that's fine.
It's several. We divvied it up, I think, each staff member took on. We only had a few staff at it, but 10, and then one person had five of them. Yeah.
Jason Brady, I just, we've looked at a lot of states and statutes when we're redoing Mississippi. One of the things that I was tasked with and did was a cross-sectional analysis with all the states for the regulations when it came down to anesthesia for as far as the training purposes for moderate sedation for general anesthesia, and if states had pediatric endorsements on top of those. And so I've done a lot of that legwork already. I'm sure it's something I don't mind passing it on to you. It's just an Excel sheet with all the references to it. But I agree with what he's saying. To undertake that task for every jurisdiction is going to be very daunting. And I think if we have a scope of practice of, like, what is it that we're trying to look for, such as I know that our non-dental colleagues were asking about some insight for other states and jurisdictions on what they do for that. I do have some good documentation on that I can help circulate around. And maybe having it more focus-driven than actually doing a broad brush approach.
How old is the document?
The Excel document that I made is
6 months old.
Oh.
But things change. I mean, you know, but...
Yeah, but it probably hasn't changed.
Earned is 6 months ago.
Well, but if we're talking about a document that has sources cited, as committee members, we could review it and decide if it's the helpful information we're looking for or not. I don't know. It depends on the committee's
wish. It sounds like it's already a cross-section is what you were saying. Right. So what I think what that was what your ultimate undertaking was, to do a cross-section, if that's already been done. We should look at it, not as staff. But
sure. I mean, whoever you would want me to forward that information to, and then you guys can look at it and say, hey, we need to clean this up, or maybe this is something we can use as a starting point.
Yeah.
Validate.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'll leave it up.
It sounds like a good path if the committee is comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need a vote on that, right? We can just direct staff at this point.
Yeah.
Please, if you would, share that with the staff so that they can then share it with the committee, and hopefully it'll meet the objectives.
You have Sherry's email, right, just from the correspondence?
Sure.
So just reply directly to her, not a reply to all.
Okay.
And then we'll get it and then disseminate it to the rest of the committee.
Okay.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. All right. So let's then move to item 6. Which is the reports of adverse occurrences. That was another item that we had asked the staff to look into. So if we could cover item 6, that'd be wonderful. Yes, yeah, I don't know how we call you in, but we're glad to have you.
Thanks. Hey, sorry about that.
Yeah. Let the record show at 1:10 p.m. He is seated and ready for service.
Thank you very much, sir.
And I like the jacket.
Thank you.
So is that something that the staff's prepared for to talk with us about? Item 6, which is the reports of adverse occurrences.
It should be in your packet starting on 16.
On which one?
61, in the packet that was sent.
Yeah.
And it starts, 60 is the title page, and 61 is the memo from Miriam.
All right. So that this is something that we had asked the staff to look into for us. Any comments, thoughts on it? Could we get the cliff notes from staff, possibly?
Okay.
You don't have to read all of it. Just
no,
what
I
stood
won't.
Out. Yeah.
Thank you. And if at any time you have questions, I will be available to answer. So I wanted to start the memo by letting you know about the complaints review process whenever an adverse occurrence is reported. It's self-reported, and normally you have to report it within 10 days as per the rule. So when someone sends in, when someone self-reports, we open a complaint and we try to get someone with the similar permit to look into their actions to see if it falls within the standard of care. Okay. Then the next portion of that memo tells you about the last 5 years, how many adverse occurrences we've had, how many were by specialty, how many were by permit holders. That's the other portion of the memo. So as the memo says, there were 17 adverse occurrence complaints within the past 5 years. The memo looked at the period 2015 to 2020. And out of those, there were 11 1301 permit holders, 4 1302, 5 1303, and 3 1304. Then those incidents ranged, there were 4 oral surgeons, 9 general dentists, 2 periodontists, and 2 pediatric dentists. Then on the second page, I gave an outline as to the board action and as to what the board considered in looking into those complaints. The first half of the second page spoke about what I believe the board wanted to let licensees know regarding the standard of care as it relates to use of anesthesia and sedation protocols. So these are taken from cases. I cannot tell you, we have the Assistant Attorney General here who kept me in check. I could not tell you the complaint numbers or the licensees, but based on the adjudication of all those adverse occurrence cases, I pulled out all of the board's feedback. The second half of that page, it will tell you that we had about 3 or 4 disciplinary actions that occurred within that time frame. And some of those actions included a consent agreement, and I think there was a practice restriction instituted in one case. And there, in the second half of that page, the board outlined all of the various problems that were found in those cases. For instance, patient management, in terms of discharge, what are you supposed to do? So I tried as much as possible to keep it to the salient points that the board wanted licensees to know. So if you are going to come before the board and have the board look at what you've done, there are certain things that the board will take into consideration.
Quick question, John German. How do you define events? In the sedation rules, there's a line item that says that dentists are to report an event to the board within that time frame if it's a death or an event requiring emergency medical response. Is that how these events are defined?
Yes. We follow it. Now, there have been times, maybe Seth could check me on that, but there have been times that we've gotten self-reports based on the use of local anesthesia. You're the experts, but I think that's not supposed to be reported. We've had persons do that. But we've told them, you know, it only has to concern anesthesia and sedation protocols, not local anesthesia.
And to follow on that, this is Goodman. Would the people that report something that's a malpractice or a liability case, would that fall into your study?
No, we have a separate investigation for those, and we get those from the National Practitioner Data Bank.
Okay, and even if they had to do a sedation or anything, you wouldn't add it in here because it wasn't reported in this bucket?
I have not seen any NPDB reports with anesthesia and sedation issues.
All right.
So far.
Yeah, thank you.
Mrs. Beanstock, of the cases that you came upon, how many involved children? Do you know?
It's a very good question. I can research that for you. But we did have 2 cases with pediatric dentists, so we could start from there.
Yeah, age, this is John German. Age would be important, I think, for us to know.
Okay. I can research that for you.
What you have here, where you've given us the broad strokes without telling us the cases as well as some specifics, it seems to help with what we were asking for in getting it done.
Okay. And just want to add, the very last page, there were instances where we had complaints where folks were using conscious sedation without a permit. The board doesn't look too kindly on that. I think those are notable for you to think about as a committee.
You don't have any, you also don't have any data, the number of sedation provided per dental category here, for instance, the general dentist, how much in the state provided as far as the total number of sedation versus a periodontist versus a pediatric dentist versus an oral surgeon. Just looking at those numbers, we can talk about events.
Okay.
I think it's also important that you look at the total number of sedation provided for each specialty, and that would also lend some information and knowledge on safety as well as dental offices.
I don't know if that helps, but I think I mentioned earlier that out of the cases that I studied for this memo, I think I gave a breakdown as to how many were oral surgeons, how many were pediatric dentists. Does that help? Does that answer your question?
If he's asking for the other part of the equation of
the denominator,
four were done for oral surgeon, but was it out of 50 cases or 5,000 cases? But you won't have the info because you don't have the case.
No, I don't have the physical files. Yeah, I don't think we do track that. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know, though.
Yeah, potentially the insurance companies could provide you some data on that, but in aggregate would be interesting. Please, go ahead.
I think we could note how many total 1301 providers there are, 1302, yeah. And kind of draw some conclusions from our own practices, how many anesthesia cases we're doing, and draw a better conclusion than just these numbers, at least, if we don't have the total amount of cases provided.
You would like to know how many permit holders we have for each level of permit? Okay.
It gives reference, I think, to these numbers, a little bit better reference out of how many are being done. There were, you know, 1304 permit holders that had an occurrence. Well, are there 50 permit holders or are there 5,000 permit holders?
Okay.
I
probably not 5,000.
Probably
just,
not.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
another question I have is, what was the outcome? I'm very fond of providers initiating emergency response when they feel there's something out of their control. So if that's the trigger point to this, how many of those EMS were triggered? Did they end up in a severe, you know, death, brain damage versus EMS called? They took care of it, 24 hours later were released. Do we have that information?
Let me consult with my attorney first, please.
Well, while they're discussing that, that part's hard, is what is the bias of the individual clinician? Because I know at the medical practice I manage, anytime somebody says, should we call 911, the answer is always yes, because you can't go back 3 minutes ago. You can't make up for time lost. So our practice might call 911 more than somebody who truly tries to figure out the answer before they call. So, yeah, you could have some differences. Are you able to help us?
Yes, I got the green light from my attorney.
So you'll research it.
So based on adjudicated cases, and I want to make that clear, we've known of two fatalities.
Two?
Yes.
So of these 17, two...
There were two fatalities.
Okay. But we don't know hospitalizations of the other 15 or...
I can tell you based on my research, some of the patients were at the hospital, but they checked out fine after follow-up. And in those cases, the doctor documented that in their report.
Okay. So am I supposed to now recognize our other committee member that showed up at 121, and we're glad to have you. Thanks for calling ahead to let us know.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know what happened with the call-in. I was on hold.
Yeah, we tried it.
I was on hold, but yeah, had to take care of my patient, so I apologize for being late.
Glad to have you. We're,
yeah,
we're talking about adverse events. We're on page basically 161 from item 6. You didn't miss the meat of the meeting. We've skipped a few items and we'll go back.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I apologize for
being here. No, glad to have you. So, any more context you can share? Well, you don't have to pontificate forever, but.
I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I will be sure to research about the number of minors who are involved, and if there's anything else the committee would like, I'll be happy to.
This is Heath. Now, it'd be interesting with the two more severe outcomes with the two deaths, if that was pediatric or old, the age of those as well, if that's possible.
I need to consult with my attorney.
Hey, you're doing your job right. Thank you.
Sorry, out of the abundance of caution. Both were pediatric cases.
So the headline would be from the last 5 years, all deaths that are related to this topic were pediatric.
There were two minors, yes.
I mean, that's at least today's info.
Yes.
Quick question, Jeremy. Can you tell us if those children were receiving, can you tell us what level of sedation they were to receive on that day?
I don't have the information before me. I'm sorry.
Okay.
This is Blazek, and I noticed, I think maybe appropriately, you said they were minors. So I think, again, the age.
Age does matter.
Age is pretty important.
That's true. A four-year-old. This is Snell. A four-year-old is different than a 15-year-old, but both are minors.
I believe at the time one case was a two-year-old. And I believe the second case was a teenager. I may be incorrect, but I believe so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Medications will say 12 and older. So there is a difference. So we jumped into some of the heavier matters, for sure. The agenda topic is to get this report, to review it, discuss it, and then discuss potential rule changes. Sounds like right now it's the wish of the committee to get more information on, you know, what you're able to share to parse some of this.
Okay.
Would anybody else like to discuss more specifically this issue, or should we?
Ali Begay. I apologize if it had been said, but do we know what the provider types were? Oh, it
yeah,
is. Okay.
On page 61, at the bottom, it highlights the types of permits followed by the.
Yeah, but the two deaths.
Oh, yeah. Do you need to consult with an attorney?
No, I don't think she knows. I don't think we know what the
yes.
Level.
Yes.
Up here or the one down here?
Up here, and you can just type it in. And I don't know the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one was a general anesthesiologist.
Wait, that didn't work.
Okay. Yep. Some of what, when you talk about statistics, though,
it's easier.
Have two tragic adverse outcomes, it's very important, but mathematically this may not tell us anything. Because, so take dental anesthesia, I have no way to even guess, but if you take all the dental anesthesia cases done by dental anesthesiologists in the last 5 years, if it's one or two, either way, statistically, you can't really get anywhere with it. I mean, I don't know. You guys know better. You did
this. This is Snell. My only comment to that is I would feel like we can get out of it that it's pretty darn safe.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If it's only one or two is two more than we would all like.
Yes.
But in the end, I think I was in preparation for this, I was reading some medical anesthesiology literature, and Dr. German could probably help me out here, but it's come down to where it's like one in 100,000 deaths. And I think this would be even less than that in the dental community with these statistics that were shown here. And I know there's some research out of Texas that their committee did out of the same five or similar 5-year period, it was like 0.03 out of 100,000 in dental anesthesia. So I think to me it shows that we are fairly safe in what we're doing. So.
I would just add that in some of these cases, obviously there are different patient cohorts that I think are at higher risk of complications than others. So if you did apples to apples comparison, you might find a little bit different outcomes. But I think what's important is that of those two deaths, if we were to find something that we could improve by amending the regulations, then I think we should pursue that. Because if we can get to zero, obviously that would be much better. And if there's something obvious, whether it be preoperative, intraoperative, or even postoperative, that we can change, and I think we need to consider that.
Yeah, and I'm some of the challenge I have trying to internalize focusing on only the reported adverse outcomes and the two major tragedies is we don't know what could have gone wrong, right? To your point, there could have been rules that would have been improved to help these cases or other cases where luck prevailed, right? So we have that challenge. One of the questions I do have from what is reported, everybody's asked to report it in 2 weeks.
Within 10 days.
My apologies. Mm-hmm. So 10 days. Did they all in these 17 cases?
I cannot vouch for all, but those that I saw, yes.
Okay, just because some might have come to the board another way.
And if they didn't, they would have been disciplined.
Oh, and that would have been part of the board action,
yes,
or consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They would have.
So that your experience is the norm is people do report.
Yes.
Or clinicians.
Those that I oversee, they do keep to that 10-day time frame.
Good. Mm-hmm. Okay. So do we want to, committee, do we want to delve into rule changes for this part concerning the adverse occurrences? Do we want to find out more information that we've asked from staff and discuss that at a future meeting? What's the wish of the committee?
I guess I'll speak. This is Ali Bagai. I think, as Dr. Snell pointed out, the incidence is very low, given the number of cases. And part of my asking, I'll be honest, the question of who the provider was, is I was curious if it was a solo operator, knowing it was a dentist anesthesiologist, shows that there was a second provider there. So I was just curious about that. And I think as far as incidence goes, it's no surprise that dentist anesthesiologists are doing a lot more anesthesia in a dental office than any other provider. So when you just look at numbers, it makes sense that that was the provider involved. So I personally do not think it's necessary to dive any deeper.
In your, even with the questions, I mean, our curiosity, our interest asks the questions, but should we close the item and focus on other parts?
I would motion that we should, given the incidence being so low.
Well, this is Beanstalk. Yeah. I would still like to know the ages of all the 17 adverse occurrences. I think it's important to understand the ages of these people.
And what the occurrence was, yeah, would be nice.
Right.
Okay.
I think it would be easy.
So keep it open. All right.
Can you even group it into two or three? Like, don't we have to know exactly death, released in 24 hours, released, but was it a severe occurrence? And what does that mean in the eyes of the staff members on the board versus was it went to the hospital and was released without any long-term adverse effects of the 17 and the ages?
So I think because it's only 17, it should be fairly easy to delineate and be very specific on the specific age and the actual outcome of the occurrence itself, because it would be subjective on our part to say, like, this is extreme versus minor. And so if we just give you all the occurrences, it's only 17. I mean, it sounds terrible to say only, but.
Also, can we know, was it a 1301, a 1302, like what it was that they were given?
Of the 17?
Correct.
Yeah, we'll look it up. And Christina just provided.
Staff just provided, and we can, of course, include this through staff later for you so that you don't have to remember it all. But 1301 permit holders currently are 164 in the state. 1302, 121. 1303, 361. And 1304, 29. So that's where the permits are currently held. Some estimates on how often each of those permit holders might use it, come up with some numbers.
Can you go over those numbers again?
Yes. 01 has 164 permits. 02, 121. 03, 361. And 04, 29.
I just wanted to make a comment on, I know that Mr. Begay mentioned that dental anesthesiologists provide more anesthesia than other dental providers. I don't that's not accurate at all.
Yeah. Oral surgeons?
Except for oral surgery, right?
Yeah, in most cases, would safe to say oral surgery would do with anesthesia? So at least of their cases, they so our request to the staff is to expand the spreadsheet and get more information on the details of these 17 cases like we discussed. So if it's okay with the committee, we'll move on from this item because we'll be hearing more about it.
I got to just say it's glaring. Excuse me.
Yeah, please.
Lysak, it's glaring the number of instances relative to the number of permit holders 1304. There's only 29 permit holders in the entire state, and they had three. Am I reading it right? Three cases?
Who would like most likely hold a 1304?
A general dentist.
And for.
That's where they have a dental anesthesiologist or an MDA or a CRNA come in to help, right?
That would not, Liz Brady, that would not include a dentist anesthesiologist. That is non-dental board permitted providers to practice in a dental facility. Okay.
But then again, numbers matter. How many cases did they queue up and do each time? Because they would have a busy day if a non-dental clinician came in.
But just to clarify the 1304. So
please.
I'm asking.
I do.
A general dentist would have a 1304 permit, and that allows a non-dental anesthesiologist come in and provide anesthesia. But the general dentist doesn't have to have any sort of sedation training at all. Is that correct?
No, they do have to have some training, but
basic
it's minimal.
Life support. Basic life support.
Yeah, ACLS or
no,
airway.
No, they don't have to have ACLS.
No, they do. They have to have either ACLS
not
or
in our guidelines.
So I just want to clarify the guidelines so we're all on the same page. That's all.
Okay.
I don't
know. Jason Brady, one last time. This was the other document that I was going to send over to Sherry. Actually breaks that down to every state as well as far as non-permitted anesthesia providers, the laws. So that information will be in there for the state of Arizona and also for other states that have those similar type of similarities.
So
thank you.
But when we're talking these 17 cases, In how I see the world, the dentist who isn't doing the anesthesia has a slightly heavier bias to call for emergency services if something's going wrong versus the person doing the anesthesia being their own facility practice calling. And nobody, individuals hate to think of bias playing into their decisions, but not to highlight in any negative way, but oral surgery might be slightly less likely because there's potentially additional training by them to deal with, issues that are going along. Whereas somebody brings in a non-dental clinician, it's easier to call 911 on them, so to speak. So we might be dealing some with bias, too. When we start saying, oh, wait, 29 licenses, 4 cases. Again, if they came into my office, we bring in non-OBGYNs to our practice to do anesthesia. And if we have just a whiff of a problem, we're not considering their board or reporting for their board. We call 911 because that's our policy and we want to call right away. So we may have bias in here too, because it, I don't, something to consider.
Well, and it, this is German. I think the outcomes that we get from the report will show up.
Yeah, because did we call 911 four times and they said thanks for calling and left, or were they major? Yeah.
And just for, this is Blasey, for clarification, Ali mentioned, and he's right, it does say the 1304 permit has to have ACLS or PALS or an advanced airway management course, one of those three things. So I was incorrect on that.
So the dentist who brings in an outside clinician would need to have that basic?
One of those three things.
Yes, okay.
What is an advanced airway management?
I can answer that because our group provides one.
Okay.
So it's an airway course that's approved by the dental board to cover certain topics regarding airway management. So
how does it differ from ACLS?
It's focused on the airway. It's focused on anatomy of the airway, intubating, where ACLS is more focused on cardiac events.
But in the ACLS, you do some intubations on that. Larry, whatever they call that thing.
Right.
Yeah. Oral airway. So it's very similar. It's more in depth.
Yeah, it's more in depth, focused on the airway.
Whereas ACLS would focus more on the heart.
Do they have that protocol? I mean, you said it was approved by the board. Is it somewhere where they have, like, what they actually teach there on those advanced airway courses? And who certifies those?
The board certifies them. I'm not, to be honest, one of my partners is the one who went before the board to get the course approved, so he would know better on the details, or maybe the board would.
Might be interested in seeing what that would involve. Is there, you know?
Because I think most of us have taken ACLS or PALS sitting here today versus, I think you're the only one that's taken that advanced. It's important for us to know what it entails.
Right. I've also taken ACLS.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
I'm saying I have not taken the other one, so
right.
I can't comment on the other one.
Yeah, and it could be that some choose the airway course after their ACLS expires, because in training they likely had ACLS, and right now they want to be able to bring in an outside provider. Airway is what they're focusing on, not. I don't know. Decisions of individuals are hard. Please go ahead.
This is Snell. And I think when we look at sedation deaths, we all know that majority of them are airway driven. So that's, I think, why the board instilled the advanced airway management if majority of the deaths in sedation adverse outcomes are airway related. That's why they gave that as an option.
Just speaking, you know, if I'm having an emergency in an office that I'm managing, I want the dentist to know what airway equipment to help me with before they know how to put on defibrillator pads, which it's on the box. So I actually think the airway is a little more valuable, but I have bias, I'm sure.
Yeah, since this issue is staying open for our next meeting, if we could have the staff provide us the information on the airway course, what the requirements from the board are.
This is Christensen again. I mean, should there be a third party involved with that? I mean, if somebody's going in and saying we can help you with this airway course, we'd also like to come in here and service your office. Is that,
conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest potentially there as well to get them through a course versus where they go and take an ACLS course or a PALS course. I mean, I
can just comment on ACLS and PALS. You're just not going to get advanced airway training in those courses. End of story. It just isn't going to happen.
Yeah, it will, again, focus on heart, right?
I mean, you'll practice intubating dummies for 10 minutes at the most, maybe trying to bag mask, but it is nothing like the real thing. So I would propose that is not considered advanced airway training.
And if you keep perspective, the individual comes in to do anything anesthesia-related has their own training. This is additional training for the dentist who brings in somebody. So it's in the emergency, great, you know what I'm trying to achieve right now versus not knowing. So, I mean, that's the idea of it, right, of the airway. So please, staff, if we can get what those are, or if you have it now that we want to cover.
Please go ahead. Here, I think just a point of clarification, because it can, influence the statistics that we see on the segment cases. If an individual provider has a 1302.3 permit, they don't have to have a 1304 permit to bring in an MD or a CRNA. So that may skew the results as well. It's just something to be aware of.
Please, go ahead.
And just something I came up with in my research, I don't know if that's possible, but some of the cases, there were persons who had a permit before, and then at the time of the incident, they held another permit. So that kind of adds another wrinkle, if you want to call it. And there were instances where we had two licensees who worked in tandem at the time of the incident. But the licensee who was the dentist of record was the one who filed. So we did not pursue the second person because that person's an associate who did not actually put their hands on the patient. So I think that's what influences the statistics. Maybe I should have said something, I'm sorry. But those were little bits and pieces that came up during my research.
Go ahead.
So Blazek, just so for clarification, so the dentist that's doing the dental work brings in a dental anesthesiologist, CRNA, MDA. When there's an instance, you talk to the dentist, not to the actual person.
Yes, because there have been times that they will put in their report XYZ ABC was there. And then we verify that XYZ ABC was not the person who actually did what happened, but they were right there in the room when it occurred. So out of transparency, licensees do that.
So quick question, this is German. So is that why there are, when you count up the amount of events per permit, there's 23 and not 17?
Yeah. Yes, so I
double counted.
That's okay. Correct, because I want to involve all the persons who were involved in those outcomes.
So there's overlap among permits.
Very much so, yes.
Okay. And then, but your first point before that over was that sometimes at the time of occurrence, they held one permit.
Yes.
And then when you're reviewing it, they're holding another.
Another one. That's correct.
Which kind of permit is, yeah.
Which one applies.
Which one applies, and how much would it matter for us if they can move, if the individuals can move permits anyway based on what they choose?
And that occurred in all 17, actually. I saw there were a couple of cases, not all 17, I'm sorry. There were a couple of cases, I would like to say five on one hand, where the person had a 1302 and then they switched to a 1304. So I don't know, when it expired, they decided I don't want to do 1302 anymore. Yeah.
Or they learned from their experience
and
said I shouldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
They didn't do it often enough.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah. My apologies for the 70s, really.
So just add it all to the spreadsheet you're doing. Yeah. Because I think that's some of what we're hoping is to get some of the additional finite information from these 17 cases.
This is just a point of clarification. This is Ali Bagai. Just a point of clarification on that. I'm sure it'll show on the spreadsheet. But so are you saying that some of these, for example, it could have been the dentist that owns the practice, as say a 1303 or a 1304, and they bring in a 1301 permit holder to do the anesthesia, so both providers are there, or just somebody that had a 1303 before and now they have a 1304?
I could recall one case, actually I'll just use that case as an example. They both owned a practice, and they were both in the room. And one was a 1303 and one was a 1302. And they both, and in the report, he, you know, said XYZ was here. And when we did our research, that person had a 1302. And when we did our research, but the person who actually did the work or was really the dentist of record, this is the person who we opened the investigation against. Okay. But they wanted to be transparent, so.
Thank you.
This is your, I mean, I think we can talk about this all day. Why don't we just get as much information?
Okay.
Amen.
Everybody's okay with it. Move on.
Let's please do. All right. Thank you. So now, more to the meat of the meeting, so to speak. We had talked before scope of work, and in that scope of work, it is to continue to review, discuss, and reevaluate. What we had determined at the last meeting was to have individuals go through and make edits to what already exists. Two of the individuals have given that to the staff, and we have it here in our green packet, our board, our committee packet. I'm quite sure many have made other notes, and we can go about the edits page by page. We can go to Hot Topics, and it seems that for order, going page by page, keeping that as our scope of work, we'll probably hit some items, because at least in the two that were submitted, there's language update that seems to apply for multiple pages. And who knows, we'll see how many pages we get through. So if we may, let's start with the Dr. German copy that we have. We also have Dr. Snell's, and then we have all the individuals here. Let's keep in mind, we're a committee making a recommendation to a board, and that board then needs to decide whether they agree with these items. So we're going to have disagreement here. That's the nature of multiple people, and we'll have disagreement at the board level too. So if we're able to find changes that we believe the board can accept as well, that'll be great. So as a public member, sure seems like the word anesthesia and sedation gets added, changed a lot throughout the document. So going to page one on Dr. German's copy here, are we okay with adding anesthesia?
So I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I highlighted.
Oh, you highlighted.
Yeah, the highlights are the original document.
The red's the change.
Edits will be in red.
Yeah. Okay, then what's the highlights of yellow? I thought those were his.
I'll bring it up.
All the times anesthesia and sedation. No wonder it shows up so often. I'm like, man, they want to change these words everywhere.
This will just take 3 hours to go through.
Yeah, I'm like every. Okay. Does anyone else have comments on page one? And thank you, Mr. Edmondson. That helps. Any other changes that we saw? Yeah, we can. That's what I'm doing. It's fine. We don't have any deference to one over the other or to one of these over the notes you've made yourself or have yourself. It's a committee. So on page one, are there any suggested changes? Clearly, the words in yellow are already there. So let's move to page two. On page two, we do, on Dr. Snell's copy, have a couple changes or a few changes at the bottom. What's the feeling of the committee on those changes?
This is Lout. Is this the new definition?
That's where I pulled it from, the ADA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you brought this from?
That was my only question. I just wanted to know. Well, no, it's, I just wanted to know.
Yeah. Changing appropriately to normally, and taking out not limited. So, as a committee, are we good with page two? They said this would take 10
years. So we're talking about the section here where he says respond appropriately, but crossed out, and you put normally, right? So we're getting rid of appropriately, and we're putting in normally, right? And then removing not limited reflex withdrawal from painful. Completely, and just putting and or verbal command. You got that from the ADA document. Okay. We skipped your one part here about usually for cardiovascular function.
We did. My apologies.
Page one.
Yeah, page one did have one red highlight for Dr. Snell's comments.
Someone can check me on the. I'm pretty sure I pulled all of those from the ADA.
I think usually okay, Dr. German. What are your thoughts?
Okay. And then there's a question here on address multiple dosing. So conceptually, you're thinking.
So yeah, and depending on how we distinguish the levels of you know, right now we have 1301, 02, 03, 04. If those change, if not, we want someone that has a 1303 being able to do multiple dosing. the intent for them to do, I know Dr. German has 1303 would be minimal sedation. Do we want them to be multiple dosing of oral meds? Do we want that, as, if they're going to do multiple dosing, does that need to be a new level? So that's why I put that in there. Just
kind of a, hey, depending on what else we decide, that could
right.
I could comment on that. This is Lau. I know our guidelines in American Academy of Pediatrics avoid multiple dosing at all costs. So it might be one of those things that we write, pediatric, no multiple dosing. But I know the docs courses for adults, they do multiple.
I'm in favor of adding a new level, or just saying if they have a 1303, that they are able, then their intention is to do moderate outside of peds, if that's what you want to say, then that's okay. But then if they don't have any permit at all, as it's written now in the 1303 section, any dentist that's licensed can give one drug, one dose, and I think I feel like clarified a little bit better in there, that it's just a single dose of a single drug that doesn't exceed the at-home use by the manufacturer's recommendation.
This is Blazek. I think my concern for the, and I, maybe I'm saying the same thing, the minimal sedation, the idea to give multiple dosing, there is the potential for untoward events, you know. And
that's, the intention is minimal sedation. I don't think a multiple dose is acceptable.
Yeah, moderate, I would agree with.
So this is without a permit, you're a dentist, you should be able to give one type of medication.
That's what the current rules say. Anyone can give the same drug, one dose, as long as that dose doesn't exceed the MRD.
Okay. And so
it can be combined with nitrous as well.
I thought if it's combined with nitrous, it scoots over.
Under the 1303. Right now, that's the way it's written.
So in theory, we could keep it the way it is in this page and address
if something
it.
Else changes, address
under
it.
Come back. Okay.
You don't think we should specifically say multiple dosing is not allowed, or?
Well, the nitrous conflict is, right? I mean,
I think it depends on how we define the level of the permits in the end for that stuff.
I would suggest we do it as the ADA does, which is that use the maximum FDA recommended dose.
For minimal sedation.
That's what they say under minimal sedation.
Mm-hmm. Up to the maximum?
It says maximum recommended dose, maximum FDA recommended dose of a drug as printed in the FDA approved labeling for unmonitored home use.
So saying this person could have taken this drug on their own without coming to the dental office.
Correct.
We can give it to them here.
Yes. That's what the...
And so if we put that in there, does it help on it? That can stand alone independent of whether we add another level and all that, right? Is everybody good with that recommendation?
Yeah.
Okay. So, staff, if you've got it, keep it. If not... He's got it for you. All righty. So moving on to page 3, there are a number of edits from both parties here, as well as your thoughts. Are we good with, on the Dr. Snell copy, taking out not limited to reflex withdrawal from a painful stimulus?
This is Blazek, and I think that'd be appropriate because that's actually well-defined, I think, in the ADA document, in the ASA documents, and in the maxillofacial documents. The idea of painful withdrawal to painful stimuli does not define level of anesthesia. So I would say, yeah, remove that. That's pretty across the board.
Just, we don't need it. Let's clean it up given the chance. Okay? We then have the word usually again. Are we good with that instance of usually? And then we have in accord with this particular definition. So to clarify that, hey, we're talking about this, not everything. Right?
Moderate. Yes, moderate sedation. So
the names aren't
listed here, but, you know, propofol, ketamine, those types of drugs, they're not intended for moderate sedation. So if our intention is moderate sedation, we wouldn't be using those types of drugs.
And, if this all gets passed, the drugs will change over time, so. Okay,
right.
So then moving down, trying to see here.
With the next thing, this might just make it easier. Last committee meeting, Dr. Snell had recommended, and I agreed, that oral sedation does not define a level of sedation, as does parental sedation. So I think that I completely agree with Dr. Snell's edits here because he followed the ADA guidelines. That it just describes a route of administration, basically. So,
okay.
So I'm okay. Exactly. Same thing.
Improve both those, really. Right? Is what you're saying?
Dr. Snell's more eloquent in his writing here. So.
It's the ADA. It's plagiarism.
So plagiarism.
All right. So I think the ADA wants us to use their information.
As I reviewed this, I was like, well, how are we supposed to present it? So I think you did a great job. Yeah, really
nice. Okay. So we're good with the Dr. Snell version there. There's any other comments from page 3 to those that have been made or others?
I have a quick question.
Yes, please.
So it's the internal. Did you take out at least breaking the
I would vote to take out sedation because it's a route. It's not like
it's an enteral route of administering a drug, or it's not the sedation itself.
Will this work for the legislators?
Well, it will go
through
because it's a
GERC. But will they be looking for words like sedation and?
Sorry, present company excluded. The people that will be looking at this will be attorneys and not doctors.
Yes.
And so I don't know how they're going to look at this, but ultimately when we go to interl, it'll show up further up because it's alphabetical because we're in definitions. So this will move up in the scale of definitions. We will do our best as staff because we'll have to go before GERC to present these things. It may be a good idea because anybody can go before GERC and testify. So not to put you on the spot, Dr. Snell, but it may be beneficial when we have an opportunity to go before GERC that you come or somebody from the committee also help present the information. Otherwise, we're going to get...
You could put internal route of administration or drug administration or sedative, whatever. But you can put route of administration to follow that, which would clarify...
Okay.
Or if you wanted to put sedation routes of administration, then have enteral and parents or something like that.
You could do routes of sedation or something, and
right,
then
that's where to do route of administration.
Or routes of, I see.
Yeah.
Already.
And that, I think if you do add that for somebody who doesn't do the work you do, we would understand it better. So
we'll probably do so that's probably better to do routes of administration. That would be the definition, and you could define routes of administration, and then it would be at least two right now, correct? Is it only two?
You have inhalational.
Have inhalational if you...
Yeah. What should be in our definitions, I think.
Yeah, that should...
We might
which we don't
have.
Higher,
or
it's not, I don't think we have that.
Not here at all, really?
So
is it the wish of the committee to add inhalation to that and then go with what the ADA has?
Yeah, although I don't know.
Well, transmucosal, they put under...
yeah, we added inhalation technique would be a good idea, I think, yeah.
Okay.
To our definitions. Yeah.
I don't know if the ADA... Does the ADA have a...
It does. Yeah, technique of administration in which a gaseous or volatile agent is introduced into the lungs and whose primary effect is due to absorption through the blood gas interface. Same thing as nitrous. So, in a way,
nitrous is inhalational. It's just a
right. Our initial missing it. We should have that in there.
Okay. So add in inhalation under your as one of your three routes.
Okay.
Okay. So moving on to page 4. So what do we, first off, conceptually, do
so
we,
can,
or yeah, maybe you can explain level one
yeah.
versus.
So
yeah,
when I
thinking.
Was going through this, this is Snell, I my original thought, and it kind of stems from the current 1303, are they going to do moderate, or are they only going to do minimal? Do we need to have everyone that provides uphill have a permit? And so I went through, and this was mimicking somewhat off of Texas's. They have level 1 through 4, although I flipped it just based on 01 and 02 that we currently have. I don't know that we need to reverb. If 1301, 1302, 1303 would still be fine. I changed it all to level 1 because I was going to add in a specific or suggest to add in a level that would allow a dentist to get a permit and intend to do minimal sedation. But my feelings is if we're not going to do that, we're going to leave it the way that it's currently written, that any dentist is allowed to do that. They don't need a permit for that. Then we can just revert back to the keep the same permit names, just change, or sorry, section 1301, that name can stay the same, but then just change what it means as far as the level of sedation and not the route of administration.
So the challenge on the level, and I see maybe why Texas does it the other way, level four sounds like you're more qualified than one, but the actual level four is the minimal amount of training. You have airway training and you're a dentist, and now you bring in another clinician. So you individually hold the least training. So I think that confusion could create some challenge for non-clinicians.
Brady, you can call them class one, class two, class three. Kind of takes the level.
Because a class one could interpret as being a better class or
right.
More training. Is it, you guys know better than me, and clearly I don't. Is the 1301 the one with most training?
Yes.
And two is next, and three, and then four?
Yeah.
So I'm with you on the class idea, because it could achieve your purpose to make it so a class five could exist. I don't know.
And then on top of that, we're talking about potentially adding a pediatric, like a 1303P permit for children under the age of 8, since pediatric is defined loosely. We said the guidelines, most guidelines define pediatric as 8.
I can't quote an article, but I think 8's the kind of the standard. It's even mentioned in PALS, too.
This is Brady.
California has said age 13.
Yeah, a 13-year-old's development and 8-year-old. I mean, that's
very different.
And I think, and then California for 7, even with the, like the 1301, they require a special permit for anybody less than 7. This is strictly for 1303, for the minimal oral sedation.
So you're saying let's carve out minimal oral sedation when you're talking about the youngest
it's
of
like
us.
Like a pediatric certificate or pediatric endorsement. Because as we get later on in the verbiage and everything like that, the requirements to do that are minimal. You get 30 hours of CE, and you can do oral sedation on a kid. We'll touch base on that.
Yeah, that it's coming soon.
Lisa just wants under 1303
three
maybe
separate a pediatric permit.
So first off, are we good with the idea of class? I mean, if we're going to ask for changes, this is a once-in-a-decade type thing. So we're good with going with class one, class two, class three, class four. And are we good with the language? And then we can talk about the pediatric designation. Are we good with the language changes here suggested?
Yeah. Basically, you just took out the routes and you put in the level of anesthesia, which I think is pretty important and appropriate. General and deep, moderate, and minimal, and then sedation for men.
Okay. So then on the idea of, please, go ahead.
Just my one suggestion on level four, now class four, it just says sedation permit. With the CRNA or physician anesthesiologist, oftentimes it's a deeper level of sedation. I know for my group we don't provide general anesthesia, but the understanding that I've always had is that that permit would allow general anesthesia. So I would just suggest that on level four it says sedation/anesthesia. Like it does on class one.
Saying that we have a qualified clinician who should be able to sedate to the same level, it's not the dentist. It's
correct. Right. Because it would still be sedation/anesthesia permit to employ. So it's still not saying the dentist can do that.
Yeah, the dentist isn't. Okay, and then other places we address reporting to that individual's board. So are we good with that concept?
I think I interrupted Dr.
Yeah, Paul. I'll revisit it because we put it on hold for the pediatric endorsement. I was just going to say like how everyone defines every single age because I've done a lot of research on that. But the bottom line was, I'll just say it now since I'm here, but Amos did go through a new codification with ADA, and they did define out the 8 and younger with their newest revision for pediatrics, so that might be an appropriate benchmark.
What was age?
Eight and younger.
Okay.
Correct.
So you, including humans that are eight?
Correct.
Okay. So, and that goes along with your background?
Right.
Okay. So, sounds like we're good on the class four being more aligned with the class one for the other, the person employed as a committee. So do we understand that, staff?
Yeah, just a bit of clarification, but not this. So right now it's level four solution for that. So you can say level four solution.
Class four.
What about four? Would you do that for two and three?
Not doing anesthesia, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, two and three shouldn't.
Okay.
All right. So, and then, and we're, and Mr. Edmondson, we're saying class now. We're classy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, so help us on, take us down the pediatric road on 1303 is where you were talking, right? Or which is now class three. Or, oh.
I guess, just for clarification again, I don't disagree with Ollie. I mean, all these are sedation / anesthesia permits to the point of, you know, any one of these levels can hire someone else to come in. But also, some of this, the wording here is via moderate sedation, via parenteral route. Well, you could go enteral route, too. So do we have to get to that, I don't know, nitpicky? I mean,
I said, like, if you're 1302, I could choose to do oral as well.
Yeah.
I think it clarifies that in 1303 that I could, as a 1303 still do.
It does?
1302, I can do 1303.
The intro route, yep. Mm-hmm.
So that would overlap that, your concern there. But if it's too specific, I'm all for.
More specific. It's fine for years, I can just leave it. Forget it. Forget I said it.
Okay. So then we're good with the Dr. Snell edits in a classier way, but back to the pediatric.
Yeah, maybe in addition to that, the 1303 permit, just say for children less than...
Eight or younger.
Eight or younger requires a pediatric permit is for children less than eight or 8 years and younger, requires additional training.
And is that something that is then...
I should say differently, additional requirements. Additional requirements.
And then we have to define.
Then
the
board would have to define what that is.
Like additional.
Or later in the.
Like additional CE course, number of cases completed.
And then.
Something like that.
Okay. Those that have 1301 are grandfathered in because that's the highest level that you can have, right? So they don't have to go out and get a separate 1303P permit or pediatric designation. It would just be for 1303 permit.
Or class three.
Okay, so class three individuals, and then class four wouldn't have to pay attention to that either because they're depending on the anesthesiologist that's coming in or the CRNA.
What about class two? Class two shouldn't. Well, this is Snell. I don't think class twos should be doing anyone under eight anyways with the training that they have, and that's coming from a 1302 provider. So
then we would want to call that out in class two.
This is Brady. I think what we have to be careful, though, is because I do agree that the concept is sound, that we're talking about levels of consciousness here and permitting to that instead of route of admission. But our pediatric colleagues would fall into a 1302 permit. So excluding that would be excluding a big portion of our community.
So should we put a 1302 pediatric permit. So add your P to class two and class three.
I would.
I prefer three, but if you feel two.
No, both.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Two and. Okay. And just call it out.
Correct.
Okay.
You know,
fair enough.
You can hold a two, get a pediatric.
Okay.
Hold a three, get a pediatric.
Okay, no, it makes.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So,
as
yeah,
a
please.
Go to permit, I also agree. I think we'll have to spell out how existing 1302 and 3 permit holders, what pathway they would take to try to acquire that additional requirement of it. I'm in full agreement.
Yeah, because where's the grandfathering of, you know, when do they come back after it's passed?
How much time do they have? What do they have to do? Well, I mean, I don't know if that's a board conversation.
But their next renewal.
Yeah.
You know, so by their next renewal, they need to.
Their next renewal might be.
Yeah, and or a month after it gets passed by rules.
Right.
You know, we don't know the day of their renewal.
Now, as pediatric dentists, would that be cumbersome to a lot of pediatric dentists? Or is it just, hey, I'm board certified, therefore I can have the pediatric certificate?
I don't think it'd be cumbersome to pediatric dentists because we've done the cases. We have 2 years additional training. We'll meet the requirements of every year. That's not an issue.
The hope in class two and class three is how does a general dentist or a non-pediatric dentist receive it?
Right.
The oral surgeons are already in class one anyway, so, right?
Right. But it's just that it gets to the point that somebody will take a 30-hour CE course and then start sedating kids less than age eight. So that's, for the safety of children of Arizona, that's our concern.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, this is Ali Begay, what we're trying to accomplish really is that general dentist that has his 1302 permit and safely provides moderate IV sedation to adults all the time gets a 4-year-old in his office and says, I'm going to do a couple fillings under sedation with this kid, and he's got the permit and he's allowed to do it. And
correct.
He can make mistakes to never be correct.
But he's never done it before.
Right. But we would be allowing him.
Correct.
And the way it currently reads.
Yeah, has a perm, has the pediatric designation. Okay.
And pediatricians typically aren't even doing that. So that's where the real discrepancy comes in.
Yeah. So, Mr. Edmondson, we are talking, the board needs to figure out some of the murky waters of how grandfathering and all that would work, right? Or is that for our committee?
Yeah, I think it
would be through the committee, but I think once you change rule, I think it would be. You can't go backwards and capture anything, but anybody that's, when they start getting permits, the rule will change that date, whatever date that is, and so it'll be that date forward.
Could it be renewals as well?
Yes.
Okay. So then everybody will get caught in a period of time.
Well, and because once the rule becomes effective, even if somebody, now I'm going to sound really, I'm totally disengaged in this practice, but they hold a 1302 and ends up that we change to class two, and there's a class 2P, and they're going to sedate a child, like in Ali's example, then they have to do it based on the rules that are currently in place. They can't go back and say, I'm doing it on the rules of when I got the license. They have to do them on basis of the current rule.
Yeah, just because the speed limit was 45 before, I can't keep driving that when the sign's up.
Right, exactly, because I owned this car before they changed the speed limit. So, yeah, it's exactly the same thing. So that's sometimes the frustration. You're kind of moving the needle, but it's to protect Arizona. And
yeah, health and safety.
Dentists are supposed, all professions are supposed to stay current on the rules.
Thank you. Please.
Brady, one other thing that kind of goes in alignment with pediatric endorsement to consider regardless of class, because if you have someone that's been out of practice or in the service and decide to come back and practice under their anesthesia permit, but they've been out of currency, there's still that concern that lingers regardless of what level of anesthesia permit that you may have. Not that I'm trying to make this more taxing on everyone, but if we're really looking at safety and currencies and staying current, then that's something you'd have to go across all levels of anesthesia.
So you're saying that we need to add a P to the other designation?
It's possible, yes. I can see someone that's been out of practice for 10 years and wants to come back and do anesthesia and decide they want to do pediatric general anesthesia and hasn't done a pediatric general anesthetic or has been in an administrative role. Does that make sense? I mean, if we're classifying a pediatric endorsement because of this.
Yeah.
I think current rules in here state that you have to do so many cases per year to renew, and if you don't, you can't renew. And then if you're applying for an initial, there's certain time requirements that
correct. I'm saying, like, if I'm doing adult general anesthesia for 20 years and then I decide to do pediatric, even though I'm a class one, if we're taking away the pediatric endorsement for the exception of class one, I don't understand that grounds if it's the same.
Yeah, some of the challenge you're going to run into, though, is the class four would be aligned with class one. So now you want to go to the other clinicians and say, now you have to get this dental. And maybe it's broad enough that it's training they have. I don't know. But
So this is Ali Begay. The challenge, you bring up a fair point. The challenge is so you're applying that to 1301 and 1304 permits. The providers that you're talking about are dentist anesthesiologists, oral surgeons, physician anesthesiologists, and CRNAs that have pretty rigorous training in anesthesia as a baseline. I don't know if that same, I don't know the training of a pediatric dentist in regards to anesthesia in general, but I would imagine that without the additional coursework, you're not really getting a lot of training in sedation and anesthesia. Is that an inaccurate statement?
Sedation, anesthesia, not as much. Maybe a rotation. So,
we could add it on all four and make the requirements of it meet what oral surgeons are already trained to do, what CRNAs are already trained at, right? I mean, and then that brings the point that we've got consistency. All four of them have a pediatric. So essentially everybody who gets a 1301 or a class one would also get the P.
California, this is loud again. California has done it for all their...
all levels.
Sedation, general anesthesia, they've done it.
So it could
be...
13
in oral, but it's a minimal, it's 13, age 13. For deep sedation or general anesthesia, it's age 7.
Yeah. It just is, we could create consistency, call out what we're part of what we're focusing on, then make the requirements one that people that are trained to do it should still meet the requirements.
And Brady, I mean, I kind of take it back to just general aviation as well. As a private pilot, if I'm out of currency, I have to go get a safety buddy to go flying before I can fly somebody else and put them at risk. So if I haven't done night flying in X amount of time, then I just have to find an instructor or a safety pilot that is current in night flying and fly so many times before I can do this. It's kind of the same principle.
Check rides.
Right. It's not about the educational component of it. It's just about currency and when the last relative. Yeah, correct.
This is German. So in the medical field, for a delineation of privileges, you can't go practice at a certain age group unless you have demonstrated X number of cases. And we have to demonstrate that every year or two, depending on the hospital system. So I'm definitely not opposed to putting a P subcategory in that class. I think while we're talking about it, maybe this is not a bad time to talk about a recommendation I made for that permit later on. But before you nail me to the wall, Just wanted to let you know, I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist, so kids are my thing. That's who I really want to protect in this state. And children are different than teenagers. They're different than adults. You know, their oxygen consumption rate can be 2 to 3 times as fast as ours. So response time is significantly diminished when kids have issues. Unlike adults, kids rarely have problems due to comorbidities. I don't think anyone is sedating complicated kids in their offices. They're probably generally ASA 1s and 2s, healthy kids. So the complications result from an airway issue 99% of the time. And if there isn't someone available who knows how to manage the airway, and I'm speaking particularly to deep sedation and general anesthesia, that's where problems arise. And so... as many of you probably know, the AAP, in conjunction with the Association of Pediatric Dentistry, last year put out 2019 guidelines recommending that for deep sedation and general anesthesia, that there be a second provider, that provider be skilled in airway management, anesthesia administration for pediatric patients. They said 8 and younger in this document, and that provider, a second provider, they recommended be either a second oral surgeon, a CRNA, a dentist anesthesiologist, or a physician anesthesiologist. I put those recommendations in my edit. Here, I understand that may open up a number of cans of worms, but I do that as a pediatric anesthesiologist, one who is significantly concerned. There's a lot of data to support their recommendation. There's a lot of data that shows that kids that age who are treated in office-based settings as opposed to hospital settings where the personnel differs, obviously, that airway complications actually are not any different. So a kid has the same likelihood of having a laryngospasm in a dental office as he or she does in a hospital. The difference was the recognition, rate of recognition, and treatment of that laryngospasm or that airway complication. and there were significantly more codes or cardiac arrests in office-based settings where a second provider who was not skilled in CPR, airway management, IV starting, and medication administration. So based on that, there's a lot of other data I can go through, but that's my recommendation in my edits.
So to clarify, as I understand, if the current 1304 class 4 had a P designation the way you're looking at it, they would need to bring in two CRNAs, or a CRNA and a physician anesthesiologist, something of that nature.
Go ahead. Yeah, no.
Because the dentist wouldn't.
So the dentist would have ACLS, PALS, or advanced airway training, correct, for 1304? Yeah, so they would qualify. They would not qualify.
I'm sorry. No.
They would be the proceduralist, and they can administer medications, correct? They can instrument the airway, technically, but they would not be the ones managing or controlling the sedation or the anesthesia.
So the CRNA comes in, are you saying too deep now because it's a 7-year-old?
Too deep. Two or more.
The dentist counts as one, general dentist?
Correct. According to the guidelines, the dentist would count as one. The second provider would be one of those four for deep sedation and general anesthesia.
Patients? No, for 8-year-old and
pediatrics. Young. Eight and younger is what they're recommending.
So then, yeah, for oral surgery, that interpretation would be for a level one or class one, class 1301. That individual should bring in a second person if they're 8 and younger. That's going to have some debate, which you know. Okay. So for now, conceptually, what do we want to do on the pediatric designation for these four classes? Well, it depends on what we're defining it later as,
I think if it's an original 1303 permit, I think it's 60 hours of CE. It's initial applicant. A lot better than 30. I think there should be some cases.
25 cases a year.
To stay current.
Kids less than age 8.
Eight and younger, so
this is class three.
The class three, you're saying keep to get the pediatric designation
initial,
60 hours.
Initial applicant, 60 with like 20 to 25 cases.
Per year.
Okay. How often does one re-up their permit? Every time they're licensed, every 3 years?
Every five years. But that would be 25 every year that you... A reappointment, you've had 25 every year.
But one could go have a sabbatical from this for a couple years, right? I mean, because so some of the challenge I'm used to dealing with credentialing at a hospital, in our space, if somebody hasn't done our work in 2 years, no way the hospital will let them do it without new retraining.
That's what John
yeah,
said.
And that's what you run into. But if we're talking permits for 5 years and we want a 25 per, that person could go take a couple years off and still be allowed.
I have a question. Is there, why 25? I guess my thought is.
There's no specific, that just seems to states. That seems
feels right.
Also 20, but also residency programs, that's what they require, is 25 cases in order to graduate your pediatric residency.
Well, my thought on 25 is, to me that seems like a lot to stay current. I don't know if you really need to do 25 for oral sedation. I feel like if you did that, it would preclude the 1303P designation to exclusively pediatric dentists. It would pretty well disallow any general dentist from being able to hold that 1303P designation at all, because I can't imagine that a general dentist is sedating 25 kids even with oral sedation a year.
Respectfully disagree. Can somebody comment? How many kids do you sedate per year? Or anybody in this room?
What are they defining as?
Kid eight and under.
Younger.
8 and younger. Is it 8 and younger?
Sure. Oral sedation for 8 and younger.
I can just speak for myself. I just have my own personal rule. 13 is my limit, lower limit.
That's your limit?
So it doesn't apply, yeah. Okay.
The dentist knows when to refer, right? So 13 is your limit?
Yeah, I agree. I'm not hold the permit.
I do too.
Well, and I'll say I do more than 25 kids a year. But if I'm a general dentist that has a practice that, you know, treats all ages, I might not provide oral sedation to 25 kids a year. And I mean, I'd like to see something to show that 25 is competency. I don't know what competency is.
Well, this is Brady. The one thing I can comment, what my colleague has pointed out, is that experience does matter. I mean, and I'm sure he's got more literature than I know about the subject at hand, but there was one that just came out through the ASA that talked about pediatrics in general with a provider that provides 100 cases versus 200 cases a year. And that difference was a five-fold increase of safety or successful rescue. So if you had to say it inversely, if you did 100 cases or less, you're five times more likely to have failure to rescue. So even though this number may be an arbitrary number in concept and theory, I understand our pediatric colleague's point of view. And also, it's hard to say, well, if they aren't getting those experiences within that time frame, maybe they should reevaluate whether they're doing.
My take on it is they would have to have somewhat of a general dentist concentration in it. I mean, these two don't do it. They refer them out. So if they want to have the concentration, 25 in a year, that's one every other week. Take vacations, you know, have to do 2 1 week. So sure seems like they would be able to get to 25 or not have the concentration in it.
Two a month is not a lot. I mean, that's not a lot.
Yeah, and so if they're not a refer, they want to keep it in-house, then, yeah, they need to have some volume to show they're doing it.
And the reason I asked the question, I'm coming to this committee from a standpoint of improving access to care with, of course, balancing patient safety and making sure you don't want to do anything to jeopardize patient safety, but we have an access to care issue as far as anesthesia and dental offices. And so that's kind of that's where my mind is a lot when I think of these things. And so that's why I question, well, 25, is that the right number? Because I want to make sure that we're not making it so that these kids that need some sort of oral sedation in an office are precluded because the general dentist they see did 24 last year.
So what would be, you're right, what would be?
I don't know. I don't know if there's any, I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm not arguing for me. If I was arguing for me, I'm going to want to say, yeah, make it 25 because now they have to bring me in, right? So I'm just thinking of more access to care. And I don't know if there's been studies. I know for a lot of things in anesthesia, there's studies to show, you know, what the competency level is to show to maintain it. And, you know, Dr. Brady mentioned the study of the 100 versus 200. That might be something worth looking at. I just don't, I don't want to attempt to try and pull some number from my head.
The reason why we came up with 20 or 25 was because that's equal to what a pediatric residency program requires.
Okay. And it's 1 year program.
It's a 2 year program.
Yeah, that's the minimum.
That's minimum.
That's the 2 years
for them to have to get CODA.
Maybe it is 2 years.
I think it's 2 years.
So the individual can start their practice off, but if they don't keep doing it, they shouldn't be able to. My concern is the 5 years. Whether you require 20 or 25, the permit's good for 5 years.
The 5 years is based on what the current, how often we have to.
License,
right? It was 5 years.
Can we
separate discussion?
Can we make the permit renewals, or should we? Or is that
I would. It got changed to 5 because it's cumbersome now. Change it back to 3, and it will be that much worse.
Yeah, even for the.
I think it's a separate discussion.
Yeah, right.
It's the number of evaluators available to do.
Oh,
that's why it was stretched.
I mean,
okay, which then hurts access to care, hurts, yeah.
Even that's a separate discussion. We could have you send in your 25 cases a year to maintain the P designation.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
true. They like submitting CME, it could be in its personal attestation that you're doing it, right? I mean, so there are things like that that could.
I have a question just for clarification because I don't know. So this is 1303, 1302, both of which are moderate. The intended sedation level is moderate. Someone who doesn't, right now, the way the laws are written, I can give, in my head, it's a pill because I don't do liquid. I can give one pill that doesn't exceed the maximum recommended dose to anyone. Can a general dentist, whose intention is minimal sedation, give that same dosage in liquid form? Is that even a possibility, or that their intention is not moderate sedation, the kid just needs a little more help, put some nitrous on him, give him one dose that doesn't exceed the maximum, and I'm good? Because the way the law's written now, or the rules are written, they could still do that.
Good question, but yeah, I think on kids you got to monitor. A lot of people monitor. They give like a liquid or something like that.
So that's
the one-time dose kind of.
Yeah, right. The one-time
dose. Right. Like,
yeah,
that's allowed.
It could be Versed. It could be a high dose of Versed without monitoring.
Well, that's something I think the ADA guidelines do say, that if a patient progresses beyond the intended depth of anesthesia, you need to stop the procedure. So that's something else that should probably be added to the rules. That's an ADA recommendation. You know, and one dose could get one dose to a child intended for moderate sedation could render that child in deep sedation, and you need to stop what you're doing.
They're a hyper-responder, yes.
Okay, this is Blazik, and just to kind of keep it, I really liked how we were going through the pages and definitions, and I agree we have to address those issues.
Yeah.
And let's maybe go back to where we were at, and then eventually we're going to get to Dr. German's points, and so maybe that's...
Yeah,
I liked how we got the definitions kind of squared out, and, you know...
Yeah, there looks to be consensus of having a pediatric designation for Class 2, Class 3... We don't yet have consensus on what it will be. We do need to have a little bit of a time check right now. I have a meeting that I have to go to. Dr. Hero has agreed to take the meeting from here if I'm the only one that's running into a time constraint. Where are we as a committee on the ability to continue to proceed today? We have enough people.
I'd prefer to stay and be more effective since we're already down here than come back multiple times.
I agree.
Dr. Brake?
I apologize. I do have a flight. I have a lecture tomorrow and one of the last flight out. So this, I don't have an option. I have to leave by like 3:15 for me.
But. So after Dr. Brady leaves, you could continue if Dr. Hero can. You'd still have a quorum. So if no one else has conflicts.
I have a conflict as well. This is Christensen.
What time do you need to?
Union to be too. So probably between 3 and 3:30. Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is turn it over to Dr. Hero to take from here, and look forward to hearing more about how this went. And it sounds like probably go tell Dr. Brady, but you guys will determine that.
Before you leave, can we do Fridays instead? Because clearly Tuesdays are difficult for people. Back to Fridays.
I think what happened is we did the survey, and this is the time that it worked out, right, Steph?
I had sent out a survey. I didn't get a response from all 11 committee members. So I had reached out. I'd spoken with Ryan, and we reached out with a date, and then I sent out that date. So my suggestion is, while you're all together meeting as a committee, being that we will have forthcoming meetings, that you maybe can look at your schedules and say, these days I'm available, and then you come together on consensus today for the next meeting, is my thought.
We can cut to the chase and do that right now.
I think that would probably be very good.
Yeah, this is
staff.
Yeah, this is loud. I think the concern last time was Friday mornings is hard for anesthesiologists and oral surgeons.
It's a Friday afternoon.
Friday, that is correct.
If we can get Friday afternoon,
I'd like to make a motion just to go ahead and let's just open up our calendars. Maybe we can look 2 to 3 months out, and maybe even a subsequent 2 to 3 months out. The more farther we plan ahead, it's going to be easier for everyone.
Yeah. The next Friday I'm available is March 20th, so 2 weeks from this, 2 weeks from this Friday.
I'm the 27th.
For the board members, there's not another board meeting until May 1st.
Is it going to April?
talking about schedule.
Whatever the individuals want. I can do the 20th, the 27th, the 3rd.
The
3rd looks...
What time on Fridays? I mean, I don't think every day should be a Friday. I think we can mix it up a little bit. This is Christensen. I mean...
We're planning next meeting. What are we thinking? Same time, 1 o'clock, or...
So 1 o'clock, April 3rd?
As an idea.
So I'll just speak to my Please. Schedule. I'm busiest days Fridays, and my first Friday afternoon isn't until May 1st.
That'd be hard.
What meeting date?
And we're in the total opposite.
Yeah.
Today was perfect. I was
Today
just a little late.
Today, cancel patients.
Well, I think we got a late notice. Is that why, maybe? I felt the notice was a little tardy. If the notice was out earlier, it would have been easier, certainly. But I do agree. I had to move some things around. But Fridays are kind of a kiss of death for you and Eddie and I. Yeah.
Would May 6th work? Or, excuse me, May 8th work? I mean, that gives us some time to...
We're all trying to shoot for something sooner.
Sooner. Okay. But your first available is May...
No, yeah, for...
I see.
But like, even Thursday afternoon, the 16th, April 16th.
Those are good days, you said, Bob?
Yeah.
April 8th, does that work for anyone?
April 8th works fine.
It's a Wednesday.
Wednesday afternoons.
I like April 8th.
Wednesday afternoons. I'm doing a presentation
that doesn't
in California
work for me
that
either.
Day, so 8th.
Me too, I'm in Irvine.
It's April 16th.
Can we do sooner? Can we do like the 3rd?
I think schedules probably already.
Right.
Set.
16th works for me.
The 16th work for
the... The 16th works in the afternoon, 2 o'clock or later. I have a board meeting in the morning.
That works.
It's 2 o'clock on the 16th works for me.
Okay.
16th. Thank you. 2 p.m.
or something? I don't know.
I may not be in town, my only thing.
Well, we'll see, and I think this has been some of the problem on figuring out a schedule is to get this many busy people to agree ahead of time, and whatever day we agree on, one or two of us, the date will change. It'll change between now and then anyway. So I'd suggest that we do survey through the staff again, but that, you know, that's going to be hard. I do need to turn it over to Dr. Hero and appreciate the time today. Wish you well, and he'll do a better job than I did anyway. So, all right, see you.
How about May 8th? Let's just get something on the calendar.
May 8th works for me.
May 8th, that's Mother's Day weekend.
Oh, no.
No way.
Listen, I'm a mother, and I'll be here on a Friday.
Yeah.
So.
But you get to make that choice.
What if we get two on the calendar? One in April on a Wednesday or Thursday afternoon in May 8th?
That works for me.
Okay.
16th afternoon, is that what you're proposing? Or April 3rd? April 3rd.
I thought it sounded like a Wednesday or Thursday in April and maybe a Friday in May.
April 8th was the one that you guys had a conflict with, is that correct?
I'll be out of town April 8th.
I'll be out of town too.
The 13th is a Monday, or the 16th is a Thursday?
It sounded like I was getting some agreement.
16th would probably.
But 2 p.m. I think is what Nick said.
Are you able to remote in from wherever
sure.
you are? Okay.
Well, we were supposed to go to Italy for my 40th.
You can't go to Italy now.
Now we're trying to, yeah. So now we're,
it's canceled for this committee, huh?
So now we're trying to figure out where we're going instead, but I'll remote in.
Over what?
You're going to have to
remote
in. That's
the week of the 13th.
So 16th?
So what about? So 16th and the 8th.
And the 8th. April 16th and May 8th.
May 8th. 16th to 2, though.
Correct.
16th to May
8th.
Are we
afternoon
or morning? Afternoon.
I think afternoon works for all the surgeons and everything.
2 p.m. sounds fine.
Okay. 2 p.m. So could staff send out an email confirming those two dates?
Yes, I will send out an email.
Perfect. Thank you.
We'll have to double check also because there's 26 tenants in the building
sure.
for room availability.
But
we'll. Right. I mean, if she can bump Italy, we can bump.
All right. Well, thanks to coronavirus
and then the 8th
being
eighth
closed.
At 2 as well.
Yeah, now it's the
time. Yeah, those are 2 p.m. and 16
to 8. Try it.
At 2 p.m.?
At 2 p.m., depending upon room available.
Okay.
Otherwise, Brian's office.
While I'm eating.
And then we'll try to run maybe another 20, 30 minutes and then wrap it up.
That's it.
Sounds good.
So if are we going back to the scope of work item?
Well, yeah.
We're on page 4 if we're going back. So.
We're on page 4. I think we've hit all other agenda items except for
adjournment, correct?
Except for
adjournment. So why don't we just try to hammer out as much of the statutes as we can before we...
If I can make a quick announcement on this topic. First, I appreciate both Drs. German and Snell, and I know Dr. Beanstock called us about this as well. As you have the time and can do something similar, feel free to submit it to us, and we'll make certain that the whole committee gets it, and we can do it even prior to the next meeting if we get something soon enough.
Yeah.
And then we'll send them out, and that way people can look and opine before we even meet, so or jot down questions or whatever. So feel free to just funnel those through Susie or Sherry, and then we'll make certain that the rest of the committee members get it. So,
could I actually take a quick moment to ask the committee for a bit? Because I was, in regards to the issues I brought up with the 1304, I was trying to determine the best way to create new language, and I'd kind of like some advice or recommendation from the committee on what you think would be best. I kind of see two potential ways that it could perhaps work. One be, and this is something that's done in other states, where we create like a new 1305 that physician anesthesiologists, CRNAs, come to the board, and it would be very similar to the way that a 1301 mobile works, where you demonstrate that you can do it. So that would be one idea of doing it. My concern with that one is it would become hard to regulate. You'd be asking the dental board to regulate a non-dentist. My other thought in creating language would be kind of like a subsection of 1304, or now class 4, that would allow for certification. So just to, as you guys may remember, the rate limiting factor in dentists being able to acquire the 1304 permit, that's really that big access to care issue that ends up, we've had multiple offices that have been over. It's been a year since they sent in their application before they could get a surveyor out, is getting that surveyor out. So my thought was that within the 1304 that you could have, in lieu of a on-site evaluation, that you identify with a dental board what provider you will be using or provider group you will be using, and those providers become certified or whatever it is through the dental board. So, you know, if I want to get the certification, I come down to the dental board, I show all of my equipment, I give all of my normal credentialing documents, you know, my diploma, my ACLS, my continuing education, et cetera, and basically get credentialed with the dental board to be able to go to dental offices. But that way, the 1304 would still become a permit holder, so that way the board would know anesthesia is being administered in that dentist office. He holds a 1304 permit. He has to send in the application and all that, but doesn't have to have that on-site inspection. That is really that's the big hindrance to getting these things through.
Is it possible for staff to provide us information about the number of 1304 permits and what the delay is? Because I know we've talked about the one, which I think one might be an outlier, is this a lot? Like, is there a record that shows so-and-so applied for a permit in January of 2019, and sure enough, in January of 2020, they still won't have their permit?
Well, and once again, which we appreciate, all of our evaluators go out, but it's on their schedule. So between the applicant and the evaluator, once the application is complete, for them to contact the evaluator, and it's on the evaluator's schedule what they're able to do, because they are volunteers, and they all are practicing doctors.
Well, one of the things that I think in some of the review that Eddie and I have been doing as far as evaluations and things like that is, in like, this is kind of a quick, easy answer, but it's not always easy, is, well, when the person applying for their permit is having trouble scheduling the on-site evaluation, because I do feel it is extremely relevant, then it goes to another level. And maybe this anesthesia committee, or certainly us providers, not the, the lay people, we can supersede in those scenarios. And this has happened with us. I mean, with, I know I've done it personally. Yes. I've been called and said, would you mind doing this? Yeah, I can make it happen. Because I don't think normally it takes that long. I can tell you with the five or six that I do pretty routinely yearly, that's done within weeks and sometimes faster. So maybe we just need to really know what the delay is.
I would certainly be interested in know who the applicant was, right, and know that scenario. Without being able to look at the file, I wouldn't have any answers on that one.
And I'm not talking about one. It's been like four or five dentist's offices that I've tried to help.
So when they apply, you know whether or not they've gotten the permit, right? Was there a way for us to go through the, all the applications last year and then let us know how many actually didn't get it, like the 1304?
Certainly. I mean, Susie's the one that processes those. So she would know the ones that would come in and when they would go out and when the evaluators were.
So much like the previous information staff provided, I thought was hugely valuable. The number of instances or occurrences in the state, and we're going to find out what the ages are, and we're going to find out specifics about that. I think that's hugely valuable. This, to me, would be another one-off related to Ali's request of, I'm thinking about trying to rewrite the 1304 permit to improve the evaluation process. Well, if we're going to do that, let's find out what the statistics are in terms of how many guys are waiting a year or 6 months or even more than a month is too much.
Well, I mean, there are timelines that we have to follow within the rules themselves, you know, but for exact details, once an application is complete, then it's just waiting for the evaluation. Sometimes the evaluator's available in 4 weeks. Sometimes they're not available for 8 weeks. So, I mean, the scenarios can change. Maybe.
And sometimes the person to be evaluated can only do it on a Tuesday. They can only do it at 7 a.m. or wants to do it after work at 6:30. Our evaluators, I mean, they have their, I tell everyone, they have their own practices, they have their own calendars. And I step out of it. I say, here's all the information. You guys work together with your calendar and figure it out. And then if I haven't heard anything, I call and say, hey, what's the status of this? What's going on? And a lot of times it's, we just haven't been able to schedule because now we've got three with the 1304. You have the evaluator and the doctor and the anesthesiologist.
Dr. Brady. Brady. So I guess the bigger underlying question is there a difference still from, like, one applicant to the next that has to go through this process? You know, sometimes I even find getting the certification or recertification for people can be onerous, but it's just a taxing system. So as long as if everyone's kind of balanced in the same wait period and threshold, a holding pattern, if it's all equal, then that's the best that we can do at this point. Maybe there's ways that we can ramp up services for that or try to do encouragement for volunteer examiners. But as long as it's not being discriminatory to a 1304 permit. And I don't know about doing a whole structural change would be warranted, unless we can identify that.
Well, I agree. I don't hear of that complaint much for the 01, 02, or 03. I just really haven't heard of that complaint about how long it takes.
I'm not making this up. And let's be honest, let's say it took a month, right, to be able to make that happen, which would be way faster than it is now. I mean, let's be honest, if a person goes to see their dentist and they've got a horrible abscess in their mouth that's causing pain and infection, and this person is deathly afraid of the dental chair and just can't sit still to get that abscess treated, and they call my group and say, hey, can we get someone out here tomorrow to sedate this patient so I can drain this infection? We would pull them up on the dental board and say, sorry, you don't have the right permit. We can't come and help that patient.
I'd have two answers for that. Not that I want to get into it.
Send into an old
one, the dentist shouldn't be doing the IND. Number two, it's just like those patients that don't come in for treatment and all of a sudden walk into my office at 4:00 and say, I want to be treated today. I'm like, dude, this is a problem for a long time.
Right.
So the dentist, if he thought in the previous months or years or whatever that he wanted to have anesthesia on board, he should have thought about that. He doesn't call up and in one day get you in there. So that's how I responded.
I don't have a mic, but I think you talk loud enough. Yeah, yeah. This is now. So I don't know that it's, I do evaluations, and the current one that I'm trying to evaluate, we're going on, what is it, like 2 months now? So it's not unique.
No, yeah.
1304.
No, it's not just, so it's not the just whole, the evaluator. It's a dental
the whole. When we get to that point in the paperwork, I think going back to Dr. Blazik's, let's get back to this and go stepwise fashion through this. But when we get to the credentialing part of it, I do agree that there could be some tweaking of stuff to try to help that speed up through all the permits.
And the only reason I'm asking the question now is because I'd like to be able to draft some language before the next meeting. I wanted to before this meeting. I'm like, where do I start? What am I going to be able to write that the committee is going to say, yeah, that makes sense? So that's why I was trying to look for a little bit of direction from you guys before I start typing.
In the interest of time, I mean, maybe that's something we can work on off hours and bring back up.
Absolutely.
As Mr. Goodwin was summarizing, I think everybody's in agreement with the additional pediatric requirements for 1302, 1303. There was some discussion about having it with a 1301. Where are we with that right now?
I just think from an equality standpoint, if we're looking at currency, it doesn't, for me, it doesn't matter what level of permit you have. You should be within those qualifications.
Are we all pretty much in agreement with that?
Well, I think it kind of depends. Are we talking about what Dr. German drafted, or we're just talking about in general where we're talking about the permits?
Just the pediatric designation for the permit.
So I actually have a question regarding that.
Okay, so I guess if we want to delineate a 1301 as having a traditional permit or adding the pediatrics, and we're saying for certain levels of training it's grandfathered in, I think that's what we're saying, then I would say yes.
Okay. So it sounds like there's agreements with all. Okay, good. All right, so the next section would be the application process procedures. Do we want to break here, or do we want to try to go a little further?
Well, because Ollie has a portion he really wants to address, maybe this is not a bad time to break. I mean, it would give you a chance to put language in there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, my language would come probably
much further along.
I was thinking that my language would get put in actually under the R411-1304. So, I mean, I'm okay just keeping on going through as we're doing.
A lot of this stuff is really just housekeeping.
Maybe we can get through this one little section here. There's only a page in a little bit.
And even though we're going through this now, let's say we go back and we read something and we can open it back up again.
That's sure.
Totally,
yeah.
Okay.
So comments on the application process.
Well, I think we need to look at the section here just for clarity. Anesthesia and sedation permit fees. Did we change the? Oh, you just made it one line. Is that what we did? Yeah,
it's the same fee. I don't know why it was outlined so many times.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's a.
If that's a legal thing, or
I don't know, address but, yeah. That. Yeah.
I think it's
okay. So leave that. That is pretty ambiguous.
I actually have a question, and I don't want to try and get in any more weeds. And I don't know if it's within the scope of this committee, but something that I find very interesting when thinking about the type of equipment that needs to be in an office when we provide sedation and anesthesia. It surprises me when I learn that a dentist office, without having this permit, isn't required to have an AED. I mean, is that within the auspices of this committee that we could talk about that? I mean, we've got it's not quite related to anesthesia or sedation, but it's related to keeping patients safe. There's no requirement that a general dentist without one of these permits has to have an AED in the office. And they're injecting local anesthetic with epi into patients that potentially have significant cardiac disease. I mean, is that, I just, as I keep reading through this and knowing what the, you know, what the requirements are for monitoring and emergency equipment.
Maybe this is the time to add for discussion possible action items for future agendas. And okay. We could put that on there and yes. Open it up for anything else and then wrap up.
That kind of baffle yeah. You?
It does. Well, there's some issues about that are even more baffling. Even in medicine, I don't think medical officers are required to have them.
They're not.
So, and physicians aren't even required to have BLS unless you're an anesthesia provider or someone in that fashion.
It's related to which the malpractice. They're supposed to do a full code if they have that stuff.
Banner made it so that their surgeons don't have to have ACLS anymore, right? Didn't Banner do that?
PCH providers often.
I think Banner made it so their surgeons no longer have to have ACLS.
Unless they're doing anesthesia.
Unless they're doing anesthesia.
Like I just got a letter that I...
I do have a question going back to the fees. What is that, page 6? I know in each, like 1301, 02, 03, it talks about a permit, a mobile permit, but that's not really delineated in the fee. So there's a... Yeah.
I think the mobile because it's just in place of.
Right, but nowhere. I mean, that's I think an unwritten rule, but it's not written down anywhere that that's the case. So under fees, I think we should. I did.
Yeah, that's smart.
That we should add a mobile permit is, and then I think there might be a what is a mobile permit provider and do we need a mobile permit provider and what does that look like? Is that one person that has 3 offices and wants a mobile permit for those 3 offices? Or is it someone that's truly mobile that's going to 10, 15 offices on a mobile basis? Okay.
So
anyone could apply for a mobile permit then?
Yes.
And if so, then why do we even have the mobile permit? Why not just get rid of it if you've been inspected and you can sign an affidavit saying that you have that place, those items everywhere, that you provide your level of sedation, why need to have the mobile if I have my own office and one satellite office and I don't want to pay $325, I just want to pay $300, I'll just apply for the mobile permit.
Well, historically, the mobile permit, the thought behind it was intentional for if you were actually that, oh, I can get a mobile permit and not have to have one for each location.
Right. So I think that should, is that something that should be more clearly defined written or does it not matter?
I would agree with, I'm not sure who said that, but the mobile print idea was that someone who's like totally, like you go to a lot of different offices, you know, and so does Ali and Dr. Brady. Versus like what Eddie and I do is we're in one location now. Maybe we have a second location that we cover. So I think we still need the mobile definition in there because I know when I do an evaluation on someone who's looking for a mobile permit, I want to make sure the gas machine isn't one of your traditional gas machines that's, you know, 6 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and you got to have the right gas machine. If they have a crash cart like I have in my office, it's on wheels and stuff. Permit guy can't have that kind of crash card. It's got to be a little different. So I'm not sure if that answers the question, but I do think we need the differentiation between mobile and a multiple office thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because I think they should. I think this is Christensen. I think they should be able to. We should know where people are going. I think that's responsibility of the board to know who's going into whose office and who's certified to do so. That's part of safety.
Do mobile permit holders need to notify the board of new offices that they go into?
I couldn't answer that.
No. The board of any location that they have.
Okay.
But if I'm clear, if they are supposed to, when they add a location for sedation, that would they send to you, this is my additional office for sedation?
But they don't have to pay $25 each time.
Not if they have a mobile,
right. Because then the board, that's the way the board cross-references that person has a 1304 permit, right? That's the idea behind it. So Dr. Brady says, I'm going to an office, I'm going to do anesthesia here. The then the staff technically could verify that that dentist has a 1304 permit and can hire someone to come in.
But this is Brady. I think the 1304 is for the non-permanent anesthesia provider, not because I'm permitted by the board, so they're governing me.
Okay.
Yeah, it is different.
The only time a 1304 would get a mobile permit, and this is where that's actually probably a good idea for classification, is if they have two or three different offices and get a mobile permit so that in each of their offices they can bring in a physician or CRNA.
This is Christensen. I just wanted to address one thing, too, that Dr. German brought up about the two provider. Since it was brought up, I wanted to just address that before we adjourn. But I have read both articles, the AAP and the ASA. I was not overly impressed by the articles, personally. I didn't think they were really well written. I don't think they had any statistical backing to any of those, to the recommendations they're making. I think a team approach is anesthesia team approach is the approach that provides a safe access to care and, you know, safe for the children as well. But I just wanted to put that there. I did read ahead a little bit and look at that. So just wanted to put that out there. There was no statistics that were provided in any one of those articles that I remember. But I'm sure we'll discuss that at some other point, too.
Happy to discuss data and statistics about this. Probably at the next meeting.
This is Harold. These are items we can add to possible action items for future meetings. Any suggestions on how we should finalize, for now, temporarily finalize the mobile versus multi-office location permits? Wrap up.
It can stay status quo if there's, I mean.
This is Brady. I believe what, you know, what Dr. Blasek is saying right now, without having any further evidence, I don't know about trying to actually unite those as one.
Okay, then looks like we're around the R411.
Anesthesia station permit fees, we pretty much ran through. You're at 11601, duties and qualifications, which I don't see really much to do there.
Yeah.
607, same thing. 608, same thing.
It was all the way up to the 1301 is the next.
I think that's probably a good spot.
Good breaking point. Okay. We have anything else?
Well, I think we've touched on it. So possible action items for the future, maybe not next meeting, would be talked about the evaluation process, you know. I guess that's kind of the same thing. Evaluation
process. Maybe next time we continue to do what we're doing here.
Yeah,
I think this was a great idea, Dr. German, awesome, and Dr. Snell, really. Because I sat there thinking, like, how am I going to do the same thing you guys? How do you start talking about stuff?
Yeah. Where do you start? Mm-hmm.
To get out ahead of time is really good too.
We can. This is allowed. Myself and Dr. Beanstock will work on a thing for the pediatric part.
Great, very good. Thank you. All right, so we'll continue next time at R411-1301. We'll work in the action items to discuss as well that we've talked about, and then it would just be a motion to adjourn unless there's anything else.
Adjourn.
Second.
Nice pitch, yeah.
Mr. Sidney?